You're listening to Disinformed, a mini-series from There Are No Girls on the Internet. I'm Bridget Todd. So I talk a lot about tech's failure to center and listen to people who are underrepresented, even though those same people's voices are critical to understanding the internet, technology, and how it shapes our world. But the internet is also about possibility. So it's also important to carve out space to dream about what the future of the internet could look like. And one of the most prolific people doing this work today is Saadet Harry. I kind of think of Saadet as the ombudsman for underrepresented voices in tech, interrogating how we're included or not included and its impact. In a recent piece for Wired called Listening to Black Women, The Innovation Tech Can't Figure Out, Saadet argues that tech creators and journalists have ignored the experiences of underrepresented voices like Black women and, in turn, ignored the harm that, quote, innovation can unleash in our communities. She writes, harmful behavior toward Black women isn't enough to inspire change until others are harmed. But the original harms are often lost by journalists tasked with covering tech. The power and rhetoric that went unchecked becomes common. And tactics used against Black women for lulls become weapons used in conspiracies, destabilizing the very nature of truth, from the swarming of victims to posing as Black women to destabilizing communities or countries. Defining systemic abuse becomes a frustrating exercise of describing an empty space that no one believes is there. Saadet pushes back on the idea of who is considered to be the assumed standard user online. Her journey with tech and the internet started with a truly hellish commute to her retail job at the Apple Store.
I had one of the longest commutes in New York, point blank. And I think that is very important because when we talk about the birth of the internet, we often focus on Twitter. I'm not a user of the internet in the way that people are excited about it. I'm a user of Twitter, social media, and certain platforms, and some of my work diffuses out. But I had one of the longest commutes in New York. I'm from Far Rock, New York. It's the last stop on the A train. I had been blogging for a bit, but I was a graduate of University of Pennsylvania. My father was deported. I had been blogging for a little bit. And I got a job as a specialist for Apple Fifth Avenue. So I came in through retail. Yes, I have other training, but I was working retail. So not making even $20 an hour. And I came in right after they started selling the first iPhone. So we got a small discount but I had the power. And as they got that and people were developing, we had internet and we were able to get things. And I was in a performance or interested in performance. So this was like, oh, I was getting to sell all my music and I was getting to look at libraries. And as those things developed, how do we use them? But I'm also on the Apple Store, the big cube, the iconic, is on 59th and 5th. I live in Far Rockaway. I've got to take the A train from Columbus Circle to the last stop. If you know New York, that is a journey. And I was using it back when you weren't sure that you would have reception at everything. Mm. So I would have a book in one hand, my notebook in the other hand, and I would have the brand new shiny iPhone. And when you get above ground on the A train, you're getting above ground at 88th. And then you're going to Rock Boulevard, and then for Rockaway Boulevard, you're crossing two bodies of water past the JFK stop. So I'm seeing a lot of humanity because I'm seeing every person who has to go to JFK Airport. That's what I grew up in. That's part of my life in the city. That's part of my life as a human. And I'm above ground, so now I have Wi-Fi / cellular. I have the new device, and I've been writing and blogging, so I'm taking to this literary form. And I'm also bringing in some of the issues and things that we've had from blogging. And for me, it's always been about conversation and building community. And my job at the time involves my gift of gab. So, hey, I am built. I am specifically in spaces. And I think that's the thing we don't talk about is this, like, you have certain talents or certain inclinations to these things. Like when people talk about, oh, Twitter is the voice of the world. I'm like, Twitter's getting better. But for a long time, Twitter was not accessible to people who can see. That's a literary form. That's already not accessible. People are talking about Clubhouses, oh, this. And I'm just like, Clubhouse doesn't work on Android, doesn't have really good translation, mostly in English. is ephemeral and has no closed captioning. No caption. So if you can't hear sight, it's very hard for you to use. You are saying because people we are used to thinking as cultural creators are excited. But for me, that is, I fit that demographic, that kind of user, that early adopter that wasn't what they thought of was me. Yes, that's how I started using it. And early adoption gets you a base, gets you people you're with. But there was a time when the actual joke of it for me is, if I was to tell my story as a person with like user research and my community background is that I happen to be connected to more of the privileged aspects of accessing that base of tech while having an identity that would make me a novelty, because that wasn't who they intended it for.
So that is all about how we build community and reach people online, which can sometimes be a bit fraught. When Facebook announced that video, not comments or written articles, was the wave of the future, newsrooms, my own included, laid off thousands of media workers in an effort to pivot to video. But it turned out Facebook was actually inflating the metrics of video reach. Rather than getting distracted by the shiny new thing, whether it's pivots to video or fleets, Sadet worked to make sure that systems that are already in use actually serve the people who use them. She worked with the Coral Project, a project to increase public trust in media and journalism, and make online dialogue and comment sections better through open source software.
I moved into user community research lead for a Coral Project, which developed comment systems, which are now used in multiple newspapers. Back when everybody was like, oh, get rid of comments. And we were just like, no, don't do that. People need to talk. We need to access. What are you doing? Everybody got rid of comments. Everybody went to Facebook comments. Everybody pivoted to video. And then, hey, they're lying about all the metrics. All your stuff is on Facebook. Oh, that was, but it was the newest, shiniest thing. And I was like, that's a bad idea. It's not about the newest, shiniest thing. It's about who you serve, what you want to do. Have you made sure that those are the people can access you? And I think that right now we're living in the fallout of that. We're living in that idea of we've created this myth of esoteric. And when people ask me to tell my involvement with tech, I always start with it's because I was poor, it was because Black, and it's because I was working in retail that I had that specific entry and this specific examination. And I have education and all those experiences, but the only way I can describe it is having those melt. You have to be all those things. And every user, not just the ones with a high profile, not just the verified ones, every single user will have this kind of story.
Think of a universe that exists on screen or on stage. How is that universe fleshed out? Who's the main character? And who are the side characters whose inner worlds aren't really fleshed out? Who is given a point of view? Sadet's background in performance has shaped her perspective on the internet, namely, asked her to interrogate who is the assumed main character of online experiences.
The problem is that we have an internet and platforms of lots of casts of characters, but who we make point of view characters. And that's a very big thing for me. And often like people watch me and they're like, Sadet, what are you talking about? I'm like, we have to start thinking about who we make a point of view character, because we have everybody on the internet and this wealth of gorgeous humanity, but you still think that the point of view character is a white man between the ages of 25 to 60 of a certain socioeconomic background. And everybody else can only be a point of view character for a very short period of time or one viral moment. That is going to affect what we think the internet is. It affects what our art is, because we are watching real time in the world about how we can't abandon each other and how we cannot pretend we are the only people that make our realities and things like that, because we are doing really badly because we thought that was the way. We need a new one.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question I have. Something that I read in one of your pieces was that we've designed an internet that does not look like the real world, right? There are not sex workers there. There are not working class people there. There are not people who have disabilities there. We've designed this internet as if these people do not exist, but we know those people exist in the real world. So I guess one of my questions for you is, you know, what are some ways that you see different experiences and identities just be completely marginalized or suppressed on the internet that you know, exist in the real world?
I am loath to answer that first thing, because I think Justin was like, we don't see them in the kind of focus point of view way. They are always the underpinning. They are the foundation of content. Their aesthetics have informed so much. Anybody who tells you how Instagram developed does not involve sex workers is a liar and a fraud. Like, that person says that, and I'm just like, ooh, you're lying on the internet. But the other thing about that is that I am not a sex worker. And the first thing is like one, and the first thing that I firmly believe is that if the thing I'm saying is that we need to see those people, I'm not the person you're supposed to be asking. The thing we need to work on, the thing that I want to work on, is like, how do we have better spaces for those people who are often already doing the work and developing the thing to cover themselves and speak for themselves, as well as how can we be ethical about it? How can we protect their security? And what does it mean for that to happen? That, and this is a thing where we often go, like when we people talk about content, it's like, we have all the content. Whose gets forward, our relationship with it, our desire to protect it is different. And we do not honor how people want to speak about it, from its creation to its access to its sustainability to its permanence. And these are the kind of, and people often go, oh, that's so meta, blah, blah, blah. Well, sometimes it's just as, it's just as granular as, does it have closed captions?
Right.
Does it have, can you delete it? Can you be forgotten? And they're made meta when they need to be singular. And that's the thing that I like to poke. And that's the representation, because subcultures change, trends change, virality changes, people live. How do we give people the ability to access and meld and create for where they are now? And how does our media that we've created work for that?
I think that because of all the things that you've said, the sort of, I guess, ephemeral nature of a lot of the things that are online, I feel strongly that our work, our contributions, in terms of how people have seen them as worthy of protection, it pains me to think that so many of the things that we have, that marginalized people have created online, will not be preserved unless we preserve it, right? And so I wonder, you know, how has that shaped our understanding of the experience of being online, that we are the only, like, we cannot trust anyone but ourselves to lovingly preserve our impact when our impact has been so great?
I think that, number one, this is an experience that we've had in history. And I think that's why the power of, like, power of librarians and powers of archives are most important, because we're picking and choosing what to preserve.
Let's take a quick break. Back. For Black folks, there's an urgency in preservation. We die earlier, and our entire country was built on washing away our voices and legacies. We have to be intentional to make sure our stories are told, let alone remembered or preserved.
As Black people, specifically coming from the Atlantic slave trade, and those things, like, we've had an experience of having to create cultural lines and cultural lineage when they did not exist, and when they do not, when they, way they have been designed to be failed, because that was the project of building the world, was help was getting us to build it without, like, honoring our contributions. I think for right now is there has to be, I think, very material in some things, and the other thing is that, like, even as I do other work, I kind of, like, I start to, like, get the itch of, like, wanting to go back and do library sciences and just, like, the basic, like, nope. How do you curate and how do you teach people to do things? And how do you hold things and not necessarily interpret everything, but leave people the space to be able to make their own interpretations? Because we have to confront our mortality and we have to confront death. And you really have to start asking. And it, like, people get exactly the face made.
Yes. Like, it's scary. It's heavy. It's, and, like,
and we're in it, but it's like, what would you want to hand someone when you're done? And can you do it in this current things? Like, I still have a Bible. I have earrings, or there are earrings for me. I can't touch them. From people I've loved, there we go through and we see the books and the architecture and all of that. And these are things for what we want to be left behind. But we also hear that in music and blues, and how are they compatible and not compatible with the ways that are accepted to leave things behind? And for us, and that is a heavy question, but it's a question we have to ask more and more now. And especially when we are also being confronted with the reality of, we die early. We lost 2 years as Black people on our life expectancy during this. What I often get upset with when we're talking about data and tech, that everybody's like, we'll get to it, we'll get to it, we'll get to it. And I'm like, we're dying early, we have less money, things are more, stress is more likely to kill us. How much time do you assume that Black people have for you to be wasting it playing in my face? But also, we have created bridges across time. Despite that, we exist in those multiplicities, because that's part of my family history, where time is thought of to be in generations, not just me, you, right now. We're all playing with those ideas of time, but we're trying to fix what are the things we want to hand, what are the relations, again, the relationships we want to have. And those are not just momentary in terms of the tweet I just sent, but they also in terms across time. What are these things and these interventions are playing with? And I think for marginalized people, but specifically Black women, because that's how I walk this earth, I am literally a living embodiment of a moment in time from a line that I'm going to try and transport through the people who I will touch, who will live different realities in different spaces. And that's simultaneous, asynchronous, and synchronous. But right now, we are very concerned with the, are we going to do enough in the time we have to make sure there is a place to give and send, because the world's on fire. And everybody's like, oh, we'll have time, because they're used to telling certain people, people who look a lot like me and you, and who are the people that helped made us, that we can always wait. And now that the fact that, no, it can't wait, when they said that, that is now circling up towards them.
How do we light a fire under people's asses to say, we don't have, like, where do you think we're getting all this time? How do we create more urgency?
We don't. Me and you specifically? Are we living this world? No. And it's I think that was glib. But I think for most importantly, it's like we have mutual aid, we have pressurings, but we are literally trying to stay alive. And everything we do that tries to ensure our own survival tangentially helps everyone else, because we have yet to figure out how to truly save ourselves without saving everybody else, specifically as Black women. I promise you, if we ever, as a collective, Black women and femmes, as Black people larger in general, if we all got together and ever figured out how the fuck we could do this without everybody else, I promise you, we would have chucked our deuces and left a long time ago. Everything we do that is designed to keep us alive tangentially helps everyone else. Because in a lot of ways, getting a Black woman to be valued in the way, just humanely, that other people are, involves a complete destruction or reassessment of the system. It does. It just does. And I am, and I walk, and I change back and forth because we're dealing with extraordinary times. But everything turns into, what more can we do? What more can be done? And I'm just like, make what I'm doing right now sustainable enough that I can actually have the space to think forward. Until I have that space, I've stopped responding to the what can we do.
This is something I struggle with so much in my own work and my own life. What does it mean to truly have space and to have time? I feel that so often, even if I'm having a good experience, I am filtering that through, you know, I should be putting this on Instagram so that people know that I'm doing this, or I should be, you know, marketing this. Like, what does it look like to actually have time? And I think that particularly for Black women and femmes, that looks, we have, like, it's just a struggle, I guess I'll put it that way. It feels like a struggle to actually feel like I have the space and time, like, to even just rest. To even just rest on my laurels, to be like, oh, I'm doing this, I'm having this conversation, I'm doing this work because I want to, not because it feels like it's so urgent, I need to be moving to the next thing. Does that make sense?
Yes. There's the NAP ministry, who I believe is doing God's work.
Oh, yes.
And it's a hard thing. And it's just like, this is, again, it was like, I very much loathe the idea of being the lone expert in anything except what I'm actually an expert in. And that's the thing that we're often not allowed. There are times when, because I think that we also have to confront the idea of, like, the hustle, struggle, grind culture is bad for us in terms of how it focuses on us in production of capitalistic values. But it's also bad in us because it doesn't allow us to get a real extent of expertise, because there's a lot of, like, when people talk about imposter syndrome, there's imposter syndrome, but there's also a system that has told you over and over again that you are not valuable, you will not be compensated for your value. And then there is also just healthy self-assessment and avoidance of Dunning-Kruger syndrome. Like, I'm not the best person for this does not necessarily mean that I am holding myself back or whatever. That just sometimes means that I have a good idea about the skills required for this and the humility to know I don't have them.
That's a gift.
You want, oh, this is going to involve a lot of math? I joined the high IQ society because I couldn't pass math. I am wonderful and great and smart and intelligent, but if people's lives develop on me getting the math right, know what I can do in the best extension of my humanity is tell you immediately to hire someone else who will get the math right that's not me. And yes, there's like, and I think there's, and I think often for me, like that's focusing like on imposter syndromes and often like a lot of literature becomes like this is how we are in comparison to mediocre white men and blah, blah. I'm just like, I have no desire to compare myself to the mediocre. I have a better, a stronger desire to create the fantastic.
Mm. Like, I love that.
It's mediocre. Like, these people are so mediocre, but they get so far ahead. Okay, and they're going to continue being mediocre. How do I make what's great? And that could be from like a really good apple pie. That could be a really amazing piece of software. That could be a stunning visual. That is all, that is where I think often I'm like, okay. And I think it's bad because for our society, like Black women, for a lot of us, it's like we're constantly trying to create. And the stress we feel is because we don't have that space where it's this thing of like, have I done everything I can to get on? Have I done everything I can to make what needs to be happening? And you feel that because you don't feel secure in what you have, because you're not even, you're making an assessment. Well, I feel like it'll go away. I don't know if I'm making enough income this week. And it's like, if you had those other things taken care of, you would have a better assessment of that.
Right.
And there's also the reality that I don't know what I wouldn't ask anyone to make deep assessments of what we're doing right now. We're all stressed and traumatized.
After the Capitol insurrection, I feel like we had an afternoon where people like seemed to be reflecting, and then the next day it was back to the normal shittiness. You know, I'm so sick of moments where, yeah, for that day people seemed to be really reflecting, and then the next day they all woke up and were the same, if not worse.
Well, it's also like I looked at every single person they trotted out as an expert and things like that, and I was just like, everybody's white.
Yes.
Everybody's from the same four schools. And people are like, do you want to be there? And I'm like, I don't know. In some cases, yes, because I have feelings and thoughts and I want to get out because I've been talking about this for years and I have moments. But then there are also scares that it goes back to the other things. Like, well, if you want to talk about it in like online community, the things that I actually have expertise in, yeah, if you want to talk about it in the mechanics of AI, if you want to talk it about heavy duty legal, there's no reason to have me there. My problem is that you have a wealth of people who should be there who are not there. Mm. Like, there are times where it's like, I am not the person you need to be talking to, but you're not going to lie in my face and tell me you can't find a single Black woman to talk to.
More after a quick break. Let's get right back into it. Black women are rarely cited or centered in conversations about the internet, even about their own experiences. Things like online harassment or the kinds of racialized disinformation campaigns that kickstarted the Capitol insurrection, these things overwhelmingly target Black women, yet we're rarely given the space to talk about its impacts. Sadet says that tech media let themselves off the hook by writing Black women like her off as problems or not likable or professional enough, thus giving themselves license to exclude our voices from the narrative, essentially blaming us for our own erasure.
Or you complain about my tone, and I'm just like, my tone is very specific. I chose a screen name that is kind of confrontational. I've got a collection of cat tattoos and aesthetics that Maybe looking back now, I might have turned down the dial on, or maybe I might have turned the dial up. Who knows? But they say something. And I'm aware of that in the visual era, and we're aware of that in the packaging brand era. You are not going to lie in my very librarian inclined face and tell me you can't find a Black woman who does not have these signals, who does not have this attitude, who does not have this tone, but who is more than qualified and considered and thoughtful to tell you similar things. You don't like me? Yeah, there are days I don't like me. But if you actually liked the work, you'd find somebody. You keep asking and pointing at me because it prevents you from actually doing the work of finding somebody else.
That's so interesting.
And I think that's an experience a lot of Black women have. It's just like, oh, well, she's a problem. She's a problem. I'm like, yes, I probably am. Or she is. Or maybe even I don't like her. But if you care about what the work is, you have a two-prong thing. If you care about the work and that is the expert, that is the person you should be talking to, stop trying to get around talking to the person. It's not about your liking, because you never seem to have that problem when it's a white man. Some of these dudes are running around being demons on earth, and actual fascists and racists, but we can't go around them. Weird, because you always manage to go around the Black woman or the Asian woman or the Latinx man, non-binary person that you all admit is an expert, but you can find a way around them because they're difficult. Mm. But you never feel the same disposition to that when it's a terrible white man.
Right.
The flip side of that being, oh, you don't like that person, they're awful, they're problematic. Yes, they are. You know what, there are some people, ooh, I don't like them working with other people, they're not nice, they're not kind. But do you keep involving them because it allows you to discredit the work? Or you are completely right. There are 7 other people of all orientation, shapes, sizes, and flavors who are wonderful and competent. Go ask one of them. Go ask them, because they're ready to work. You create a roadblock where there isn't, and you create a roadblock because it serves you. And you create it because it serves you. But what we're asking you to do right now is serve everyone else.
Well, I think something that you said that really sticks with me is this idea of just who we hear from and who we don't hear from, particularly as it pertains to talking about online communities. You know, in the aftermath of the insurrection, like how many different experts from the same 4 schools did we need to hear from? How many different, you know, how many different outlets rushed to interview a Proud Boys member or a QAnon believer, and just how little they center the people who are directly impacted. So we didn't hear about the Black women who have been talking about online harassment since forever, who, you know, if someone had listened to them, someone with power, this whole thing might have gone differently. We just didn't even have that conversation.
And this is where my rude steps in. But people love when I challenge them on that, to be like, well, I've just been starting since 2016. I was like, I had my first run-in with some of these people in 2012 and 2014. Mm-hmm. Tell me you don't care and keep it moving, but do not waste my time. Well, we know you were going to reach out. It's like, you told me in a tweet. I know for the other thing about it is because the work I tend to do tends to be design sprints and user research and archival. And this is a little quirk that I've had for a while, is that there sometimes there's awful things about people who are hiding from ghetto names and things like that in HR and how hiring works, is that I have a very kind of, my name is distinct and it's hard to find. And because SEO, Black woman, they shoved me down visually for now. If you Google me and you don't see a picture of my name, a lot of people think I'm white. A lot of, because of my name, if you don't see a photo and it doesn't surface a photo, people think I'm white. And because of my family is West Indian, and my mother had a very slightly odd obsession with speaking properly. And up to the point that when, up until I was like a certain age, I actually had a vaguely British accent, and it's something I will default to. And like, we all code switch in like your professional voice.
Right.
And you sometimes will hear me doing it in this, but it's like when I'm like, my professional voice is, good afternoon. My name is Sadette Harry. I will be your proctor for the day. And if you're not looking directly at my gorgeous Black face, people think I'm white. So I've often experienced this where folks will say and talk to me face to face when they're looking at me or about things or when they see my ave, and they will the different, like, they're just like, well, you don't understand or you don't comprehend, and maybe you, and I like, and all of this, and I'm just like, mm-hmm. And who are you citing? They'll cite an article I wrote for Model View Culture or sometimes. Now it's happened to me once or twice for Wired now. And I was just like, you just cited, oh, what's that? Sadette Harry. And it happens to other women too, but there is a specific racial tint for it sometimes. Or like someone will call me on the phone and then meet me in person after I've done some user research. And they're like, yeah, I spoke to this woman on the phone, Sadette. And she was, and like that happened to me more than once or twice. And I'm not going to say when to protect people. But they were just like, yeah, she had these really great thoughts. And she was really connecting it to manuscripts and other things. And I was just like, uh-huh. I was like, I know you're, and this is the person who actually started going into it. Like, I know you're more social because they read social media in some ways, especially for Black women. They read social media adeptness as a fad and not a skill. Mm-hmm. Like,
I hate that.
There are a lot of white male journalists who are doing exactly what I was doing in 2016 now, and they're paid for it. Like, they barely write articles. They just tweet. For me, it was a problem. For them, it's a job. And they'll be like, yeah, she talks about these things and da da da. And I was like, very interesting. And I'm just like, Sadette Harry? Yeah. And, like, I'm just like, and they're just like, oh, so I'd like to follow you on Twitter. And I was like, okay, this is my screen name, Black Amazon. And they're like, wait, you're Sadette Harry? Yes, I am, darling. God.
What is that like?
What a mind fuck. It's a mind fuck we Black women experience. Like, it's an interesting, like, that's my version of it, but I believe there are Black women all over the space that has said, like there is a very, like, for me, the experiences, and I talk about the tattoos, I got my tattoos later in life. All of them started over under 30. And if you haven't gotten it yet, be careful, because, like, I got mine after 30 and it's an addiction. I'm just joking. I'm just like, I haven't had a tattoo in nearly a year and a half. Y'all, somebody give me with a needle. I need it. But like, I was talking to someone who was probably a very well-minded theorist, and they were like, but at the origins of the internet, and I was like, let's talk about print culture and mass communications, and that's my thing. And they were like, well, it's strange, and like the person was very much hedging, and I was like, because I have tattoos on my right forearm, and one of my right forearm is specifically designed to be the typescript for the first mass-produced slave sheet. Wow. Which is also convincingly enough, oddly enough, TypeScript for the first really serif fonts that were printed, the first folio of Shakespeare.
Really?
We nerd hard in these streets. but it's also like it's a telling part of our culture that like the mass production of the identity of Western literature was also the same mass production that was used to retain Black enslaved peoples. To create nations and create identities. And I was, and it's like, this is a, and these were people who were just like, well, it's not professional and it's unprofessional. And I was like, great, it's not professional. Well, that doesn't mean that I don't understand the historical significance.
Right.
But that is the thing that, like, for me, I experience sometimes visually tattoos. But I think sometimes Black women experience it with your speaking choices, your names. Are you really an engineer? I think all Black female engineers I've heard experiences that, like, you have to put out more. You might do some performances, or your performative cues are read differently, but you have to do more work. And the mind fuck of that is just like, I don't know what it's like to not have to do that. You, in sections of your life, don't know what it's like to not do that. That there is a, like, there is a world, or there is an identity and experience that at some point, people just believed what was true about you without you having to do more than that. That's the screw up. It's like, I'm at this point where I'm like, okay, we're going to go around, you're going to get it, and then I'm going to have to braid you up a bit. And whatever that is, and that I can or whatever, can or cannot do it, that's the thing. But I think the mind screw is that there is someone whose entire life they've never had to do that. That's the thing. Because I'm just like, oh, this happens. Like, I've had men, like, just try and upbraid me about, and especially within tech media and tech journalism, as everybody has slowly moved into missing disinformation and online harassment, I'm just like, you are so new. They're like, well, if you knew, and I was like, so what's the number one Like, there are two books that were New York Times bestsellers, and it is also for me. I've talked about this before, and I feel like somewhat of a jackass when I do this. You cited two books about New York Times bestsellers. Please go to the acknowledgments or the dedications.
That's gotta feel my name. That's gotta feel good. Like, that's gotta feel good in a kind of way.
That feels good because I'm an egotist, and I gotta bring you up. And it feels good because no matter what, I'm a New York John. I'm a New York shorty. Always have been. And sometimes you got to let these people know. That feels good on that level because you better ask somebody. But it also feels terrible because, like, these are experiences that were difficult and these are relationships and moments. And rather than just believe towards the goal of, no, we're trying to stop the abuse, we're trying to stop these experiences, we get, I've got to spend 20, 30 minutes or 10 minutes or a really uncomfortable situation of me looking at you like this, like, tell me more, rather than us actually doing the work of improving the thing. What would have happened if I didn't have to go through that? If I didn't have to pull out all the, what happens, like, we talk about receipts, but like the stress of receipts, what would happen if instead of a day, a week, a month, a couple years of us having to pull receipts, trying to prove what happened, you just did the work. We just got to do the work. Like, that's the thing that is very like, oh, you want that moment. Like, that to me is the actual mindfuck. Like, in those moments, you realize how much, and with time, you realize how much energy you have wasted, right? Necessary and unnecessary. Because, like, sometimes you need to do it to get it done, and sometimes you do it out of reflex. But how much of that time is taken from the thing you want to do? Because and it goes also to big, because for some people, and there are some people who are, there are some people who, like, when they dress them down, you're just like, ooh, that was beautiful. That was a piece of art. Go, girl. Tell them! Like, you get that. Like, there are some people who are skilled at that. And it's a beautiful to watch them work, and they enjoy it. And I love that they enjoy it because they are good at it. I might have some facility. I'm not as good as they are, but for me, I'm usually just tired. I'm like, okay, so we did that. Now we're done. Like, we don't know. You good? You good? You're good. Let's get to work.
I have to ask. This is kind of a random question, not related to. I guess it is sort of related. You are so yourself. You know, even looking at you right now, you've got the Prince shirt, these bold glasses. How did you find the freedom and space to show up like this as yourself in this way? How did you walk in this confidence as who you are in some of these spaces that you walk in?
There's a performance training. I am friggin' lying. I've done theater. I studied opera for 9 years. I am very good at the fake it or till you make it, or the ask for confidence and confidence should be given to you. When you're good at performance, and it's one of the things I talk about, it's just like, I'm often nervous. One of the last big speech I gave, I spent a lot of time on the tables, and I was like literally with the person I was talking to, like, oh my God, why are there so many people? It is a performance. You get up, you get ready. I was trained in that. You get up, get ready, sell it out. And then, like, the minute you step off stage, you kind of curl in a ball and rock back and forth. Also, I've talked about it before, but like my I like theory. I like wonky stuff. I like the combination of like looking at the things and just making them happen. That allows me to have a lot of interior time, or time in stacks and time in books, to just be myself. Some of it is just like the way I was born precluded me having another option. We are not seeing people in full body, and like the pandemic is discomfort. We're all discomfort, losing weight, gaining weight. But at my general right now, I'm about 5'11", 250 pounds. So there's like not a lot of I can hide in my person. And that is a, like, I'm a tall human. And it seems like a strange thing to be so formative. But for me personally, there's not a lot of option of camouflage. There's not a lot of like, hey, I'm going to walk into certain rooms unnoticed, and especially as a Black woman. And I was part of, I'm from Far Rock. And this is a under-resourced neighborhood. We have certain access that we don't. So I was in a lot of places, like one of the lonely onlys. I couldn't hide in a room. I would be purposely ignored. But I'm going to have to be this person. And the way I am built, both physically and emotionally, was like, I want to lead this challenge, or I want to at least get good at faking it. Like, people were like, I have such anxiety sometimes about large groups of people. I know how to make that anxiety look like I'm working the room. But it's like, here's a quick tip. If you really don't like talking to large groups of people and you're in a large group of people, if you are very intimately and personally find every single person and talk to them for 2 to 3 minutes, it looks like you're working through the room. You're actually working the runaway.
People are like, she's the life of the party.
That is a specific thing for me. It was important for me to develop a skill. I felt it necessary to develop a skill that I was going to be very solidly myself. I was going to be strong about it. I was going to be clear about it, because I didn't have the option for other things. One of the things that a lot of some of my online things, people are like, oh, you're being mean, and this person is so nervous and anxious. And I'm like, what makes you think I'm not? Why have you decided that I'm not anxious? Why have you decided that I'm not scared? Or have you decided that it's okay for me to be scared based on what you think I am allowed to be? Because there have been a lot of times I've been like, oh, you're the big mean monster. And I'm like, okay, no, I'm not. Because while I'm talking to you, I'm on the phone with somebody else and I'm crying. I am heaving sobs. Like, oh, you, like, there are times when, and a lot of times with Black women, it's like, anybody who defends you, like, oh, you're just sticking your people or your followers on them. And I'm like, what would happen if you thought of them as my friend? What would happen if you thought of some of the people who are saying back up or leave me alone are saying that because they know me as a human and they know that this affects me? What happens if my distress wasn't funny to you or a topic to you? And I think that goes back to like what we were talking about for the subject. And a lot of this is that people say Black women, but they don't name them. And it's the back to the citations of Black women. It's like we become a concept. We become a... They'd say Black women the way you would say pineapple or like fruit. Like, oh, fruits have this composition, like not, but it's not sentient being. And with the engagement, what's happening to us is along the same lines. Like, it's very much, we are a thing to be discussed, but we are not people with which these things have effects on. They mean things. And often being like, no, this hurts. No, this is scary. Like people, I was like, people often say like, oh, you like, oh, like sometimes I told you so is not an admonition. It's not a dunk. It's a cry for help. Sometimes I told you so is a question. Like there are a lot of times like, we told you or I told you so. It's like, I am not trying to be the smartest person in the room. I really want to understand what was it about what I said that didn't register for you, that didn't make you act. And what would it take for it to be something you acted upon?
So that brings me to my big question, you know, what could the internet look like if we listened to Black women and recognized our humanity and centered us? What could the internet be like?
The internet would look like the world. The internet would look like a world we actually live in. I would love to know what an internet that could could honestly describe the feeling of having a really good piece of pineapple with loved ones at the edge of the beach when you weren't exactly that moment of just like,
I had a moment
because we're like, oh, you bite into a pineapple and it is exactly what you want in a space you want, or like when you have ever read or heard something and it sparks something in you in that moment of just, oh wow, that, what would happen? Or what would happen if the places where you bought your clothes showed people who looked like you? Or what would happen if when you looked at descriptions of your neighborhood, it wasn't just the same things? Or like those spaces at that time, or what would happen if when something said all access, it was actually all access? That you could sign into something and it wasn't about worrying whether or not you had anything. Like movies and cinema are a big thing. And like those are, it's rough because those are some of the largest pieces of mass communication and the largest places we get culture and the most resistant to talking about it in any way that does not involve gatekeeping. But it's just like, what would happen is when you walked in a movie theater, you knew you could watch the movie. For people who are visually and auditorily abled and mobility abled, we never have to think about that. There are so many people who do not, who have to think about that. Does it have hearing capabilities? Does it have visual descriptions? Or is that an only one showing? That is a huge part of, like, if you're from the world and like you're actually from the world, you went into something that talked about the city you lived in, and the story actually looked like those people you encountered in your life. Or that if you went to and I like movie theaters because they're both visual and media consumers, but if you were looking at the showings and we're looking at the showings in a big city that had multiple languages and had people of multiple languages, when you looked at the cinema, you knew that someone could come in and hear what they needed to hear, or that at least one of those stories reflected them, and that they didn't have to worry about that. Those kind of tease outs and changes. And I think for me, the way I would close it is that what would the world look like if they listened to us is another question, is what would listening look like? It's like there would be a constant conversation of making everything to do that, to do something new and to do something fun, not just profit off of it. And that space, which is still ambiguous and isn't an answer, would be magical. And I think that would lead to multiple more conversations. But like, I think of Pineapple by the ocean, surrounded by people, and a way to actually convey that in all of these mediums. And that's what happens. Like, people will tell you how to sell that. Right now we talk about how to sell it, how to influence, et cetera, but to actually convey to a person point to point, heart to heart, this is what it feels like for me and for you. And that is both, like, for me and you, Pineapple by the ocean sounds great, but what if we had somebody who liked apples or apples and the hills? That is a completely different thing. And they would be like, And here's the thing, I want to know what that feeling is like. I want to know what they think of that. I don't necessarily need to make them feel the same thing I do. But that to me is the crux of it. Like, we what would we get if we actually move towards having those discussions and not about these who influences what and does what? Like, that's the question for me. If that actually answers
it. It answers it beautifully. Now I want Pineapple on the beach. It answers it beautifully. Sadet, I cannot thank you enough for taking the time to speak. I have chills. Something about the way you show up in the world is such a gift, and I am so grateful that you are a human who exists.
Thank you. I'm grateful for you.
Oh, please.
No, but I am. No, don't you dare. Don't you dare. This is a real thing. Every day we look at Black women and we are often feeling it alone. We feel we are unseen. We feel misunderstood. And every day I get to look at you and I get to look at others, and we're here and we're building. So I am grateful for you. And please understand, that is honest and true and meant from the heart. You are amazing, both for being Bridget, but also for being human. No one else likes you exist in this moment. I am thankful for that. You cannot cry. You cannot cry or I'll cry. And then no. Bad. No. Stop. Stop it.
I appreciate you so much.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please help us grow by subscribing. Got a story about an interesting thing in tech, or just want to say hi? We'd love to hear from you at hello@tangodi.com. Disinformed is brought to you by There Are No Girls on the Internet. It's a production of iHeartRadio and Unbossed Creative. Jonathan Strickland is our executive producer. Tari Harrison is our supervising producer and engineer. Michael Amato is our contributing producer. I'm your host, Bridget Todd. For more great podcasts, check out the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.